Oh, and we turn to Ezekiel, the 14th chapter. And I don't know whether I'm going to be able to cover the 16th chapter or not. I know that I can cover the 14 and 15 in just a little while, because there are only about two or three thoughts in this 14th chapter. At least two in there. One of them is the elders come unto him. Now, in the 13th chapter last Sunday, you remember, we talked about the false prophets. Now, in the 12th chapter, the prophet had two things that he did. He did two actions in which he taught lessons by that. Then he turned to the false prophets and the prophetesses and condemned them. Now, in this 14th chapter, he condemns idolatry. Now, idolatry and false prophets were really the great curse of the people. They turned to idolatry, and the false prophets would prophesy falsely, and they listened to them for what they wanted to hear. So we have these problems set forth. We dealt now with the false prophets and prophetesses. He turns now to idolatry. And his charge is that the people have taken the idols into their hearts. Well, that's exactly what people have done today. We take our idols into our hearts. I don't know of anybody in this country that bows down to a little image, but we do know that covetousness is idolatry, Paul said, and a person can make an idol out of pleasure, make an idol out of anything that he puts before God. So I think we can get a lesson out of this, beginning with verse 1. Then came certain of the elders of Israel unto me, and sat before me. Now, I don't know whether these are the same elders of the 8th chapter, you remember, that he was in his house, and the elders came, sat before him, and had that vision in which he was transported to Jerusalem, and then dealt with four chapters, then he was brought back, and still in their presence. So whether this is the same group or others, we're not sure, but that's probably the same. And sat before me. And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, these men have taken their idols into their heart, and put the stumbling block of their iniquity before their face. Should I be inquired of it all by them? Now, before they say anything, or Ezekiel says anything, God tells them that these individuals have the idols in their hearts. Now, if they want to ask a question, am I responsible, or should I answer that question? Well, of course, he goes on to say, no, I'll answer it all right. I'll answer it my way and not the way they thought they wanted me to answer it. Well, you'll tell us that. So, should I answer? Therefore speak unto them and say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, Every man of the house of Israel that taketh his idols into his heart, and putteth the stumbling block of his iniquity, and that would be his idolatry, before his face, and cometh to the prophet, I, Jehovah, will answer him therein according to the multitude of his idols. But it will be an answer of judgment, and not an answer to the question that the fellow wanted answered. That's what God's going to point out here. So the false prophets and the idolaters are the great stumbling blocks and the great enemies of the people. Now he goes on, the multitude of his idols, that I may take the house of Israel in their own heart, because they are all estranged from me through their idols. So I'm going to take them according to what's in their heart. Now if they've taken their idols into their heart, I'll deal with them one way. If they've put me in their heart, I'll deal with them another way. Well, God hasn't changed on that. That still is true today as it was back then. But now he moves on, therefore. Now, in the light of what I just said about these idols and the hearts, therefore say unto the house of Israel, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, Return ye, and turn yourself from your idols, and turn away your faces from all your abominations. Now, to turn away would be what? Repentance, wouldn't it? Repentance is a change of mind or will. That results in turning. So what he's calling upon the people here to do is to repent, to turn from these idols and turn unto God. Well, you remember Thessalonians, the first chapter, and the first Thessalonians, verse 10, Paul says there that the people have, that called upon the people to turn from idols unto God to serve a living and true God. Well, that's what they had done over in Thessalonians. You turn from idols unto God to serve a living and true God. Well, that's what God called upon people to do today, to turn from the idols that they've set up in their hearts unto God and serve the living and true God. And I think that we don't think of ourselves as being subject to idolatry, and yet, folks, we are. any time that I put anything before God, and that becomes the thing of my life, that becomes my idol. God looks upon the heart. So I can make pleasure. I can make business. I can make making money. I can make this or that. I can make my family, as much as I should love them. I can make them my idol by putting them before my relation to God. Think of idolatry then as being of the heart in which we put anything before God. And it's very easy for us to do that. And we don't think we're idolaters, but in God's sight we may be. On the other hand, of course, we may not be. For every one of the house of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn in the midst Israel, that separated himself from me, and taketh his idol into his heart, and putteth the stumbling block of his iniquity before his face, and cometh to the prophet to inquire for himself of me, I, Jehovah, will answer him by myself. I'll answer him what I want him to hear in the light of his idolatry. So if an individual comes to God and has something in his heart that he's putting before God, he really can't ask God in faith, because his faith is in something else. His interest is in something else. Maybe that's why sometimes our prayers are not answered. Maybe we put self or selfish purpose or selfish inclination before the will of God. Jesus taught, when you pray, thy will be done as in heaven, so on earth. I must always pray subject to the Father's will. Now notice, I, Jehovah, will answer him by myself, and I will set my face against that man and will make him an astonishment, for a sign and a proverb, and I will cut him off from the midst of my people, and ye shall know that I am Jehovah. Now, that expression, I know you've noticed it so many times, 54 times, that expression, that I am Jehovah, is found in Ezekiel, plus 18 times, in which there's something else added to it. So that, you see, makes 54, 72, doesn't it? 72 times, that expression is found in the book, either 54 by itself or 18 with some additional thought to it. So what is the real emphasis of this book? God is speaking. God is acting. Now, the doom that I'm pronouncing is the result of your conduct. The hope will be in your turning unto God from that which has estranged you from me. Just as true today as then. So Ezekiel, his message is just as pertinent to the people of today as it was to people of that day. It's a really neglected book. I doubt. I think I went through it once before here, and I don't know whether altogether or not, but I did talk about it, I believe. But I doubt if you ever heard a study on it until we made the study here. You may have, but I doubt it seriously. Why? Because our brethren have neglected it. We neglect this book. We say, well, it pertains to them. It doesn't pertain to us. That's not so. Sure, it was to them. But principles do not change. The principle on which Ezekiel dealt with the people of that day reflect the character of God, and God is unchangeable. Therefore, the principle laid down are as unchangeable as God himself. This is why we need to study the whole Bible, all of it. And so, but most of the brethren think, no, we don't need to study that. Well, I think we can go to heaven without it. I believe we can, but I don't. I know a whole lot more about God and his way of doing things if I do study the whole Bible. All of it. It's all the Word of God. Well, already moves on. And if the prophet be deceived and speak a word, I, Jehovah, have deceived that prophet, and I will stretch out my hand upon him and will destroy him from the midst of my people Israel. Now, as a prophet, that's a difficult proposition, a difficult statement there. I have deceived him. Now, in what way could God say that? I think 2 Thessalonians 2 and verses 10 and 11 and 12 on there express the idea, because they receive not a love of the truth, God sendeth them a working of error, that they might believe a lie, that they all might be condemned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Now, there are just two things before us. There's truth and falsehood. That is the worship of God or not worshiping God. Now then, if I turn away from the truth, what is there left for me to turn to when I leave truth? Error, isn't it? For if I choose not to love truth and seek after truth, then God allows me to believe a lie and be damned. That's what Paul said in Thessalonians. All right, you've got the same thing back here now. God says, I sinned, but there's a secondary cause there, and that is the individual's own attitude and disposition toward God, don't you see? And then the God arbitrarily deceives the fellow. He first of all leaves God, and there isn't anything left but deception. So since God directs the affairs of mankind, why then he allows them to believe the lie, they might be condemned. So what then is the basis of an individual ever learning the truth? Love for the truth. Because they receive not a love for the truth. God sent them a working of error. Now here the working of error that they might believe a lie. He didn't make them believe a lie. He sent them a working of error. Through that they believed the lie and followed it. That's what they wanted to believe, you see. Well, that's what Ezekiel is saying back there before Paul ever said it. Because this is a principle that God in all time. Now I think there are a lot of folks think they love the truth and want to know the truth, and I really don't think they do. I tell you, one of the hardest things in the world to overcome is the prejudice of a traditional view that one has taken. If I was brought up under a situation, I was taught this, and I believe that, and it may not be true. But now for me to just come before, to God with a blank mind and say, I want to know the truth on this, I'm going to search for that. I believe that's the only way God will ever allow man to have the truth. I mentioned to you a number of times. I don't harp on this, but I do mention it. I hold a position on the baptism of a person who's been divorced and remarried before they obey the gospel. They're different from the brethren. They're jumping on the two papers of one of them, that half of the whole issue on me and more to come, and the other one there's dealing with it also. Now, I may be wrong in my position. I want to tell you one thing. I didn't come to God to try to prove anything. I came to the Bible to see what God said on the subject, what he didn't say. On the basis of what he said and what he didn't say, I could make my conclusion. I'm not going to charge any man with dishonesty. I just think he's blinded by the prejudice that's been built up in his mind for a traditional view that keeps him from looking at anything else with a fair mind. I tried to read what two of the fellows said in their papers about me. I'm a little Irish in me. And I guess that Irish came to the front. And I got kind of upset and good. I quit reading. I think I read and I'll call the words. Didn't really. Well, am I doing the same thing they do? Am I closing my mind to what they have to say? No, if they'd have grappled with the issue, I'd have read it. They were after me. They wanted to destroy me in the minds of the brethren. And that then would destroy their confidence in what I said. Now that to me, and I'm not criticizing it perfectly for their business, and I'm not bitter toward them at all. I just think that I'm learning a lesson here that because a man doesn't have a love for the truth, God allows him to believe something else. But let's come to the Bible. Let's come to it. Let me come to it to see maybe I have been wrong. But I came to it to find out what the book teaches on that. I've tried to do that on everything else. Sometimes we stumble. Well, all right. This is a lesson, I think, that Ezekiel is teaching here that we can learn today, don't you see? That's what I'm trying to say. Well, he moves on here. When he says here, I'll destroy them. Now verse 10. And they shall bear their iniquity. The iniquity of the prophet shall be even as the iniquity of him that seeketh unto him, that the house of Israel may go no more astray from me, neither defile themselves any more with all their transgressions, but that they may be my people, and I may be their God, saith the Lord Jehovah. So what he wants now is the people to listen only to him and to his word and follow that. And that's what he still wants. And so without being prejudiced for a traditional view, let me examine that view in the light of truth. I'm making an intensive study of Romans. I've never understood Romans. I don't know why. I didn't work hard enough at it. I'm spending at least a day or 2 days each week on one chapter at a time. I think I'm beginning to understand what Paul is talking about in the book of Romans, as I never did before. I've always known he was dealing there with grace, salvation by grace through faith. But so much of what he said, I didn't grasp what he said. I shouldn't say I couldn't, because I could. Because grappling with it, really grappling what he said, sit down and read a chapter over 10 or 15 or 20 times. Judge, I'm reading that chapter and looking at it. Now, what's he saying? First, find out what the book says. Now then, begin to analyze it. Now, what is he saying? Hear his words. Now, what is he saying? What's his message? Well, I think that's the only way you'll ever learn the Bible. First, understand what is said, then come to understand what is said. You see, you first get to see the words. Now, what do the words mean? How do they fit together? I haven't conquered it yet. I'm a long ways from it. But I think I have a lot better understanding than I had a few months ago when I started in on the study. Well, let's pass on that. These are things that I think lessons we might get if we go along. And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, the land sinneth against me by committing a trespass, and I stretch out my hand upon it, that is the land, and break the staff of the bread thereof, and send famine upon it, and cut off from it man and beast, though there be these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord Jehovah. Now, with verse 12, he introduced another thought. Here's the idea. You look back at Genesis, the 18th chapter, when God said he was going to destroy Sodom. You remember that Abraham prayed unto God, if you find 50 righteous persons, will you spare? Yes. If you find 45, will you spare? Yes. 40, 30, 20, 10. He got down to 10. He couldn't go any below that. He wouldn't say anymore. If you find 10 righteous persons, will you spare the city? God, yes, I'll spare it. All he could find was Lot and his wife and two daughters. That's all. He delivered them. But now then, on the basis of that, maybe these people now say, I think they're now saying, right, there's still a few righteous people in Jerusalem. Now then, Lord, will you save the city or spare the city because of the few righteous ones there? God says no. No. If Noah and Daniel and Job were there. Now remember that Noah delivered his family by his faith. Remember that Job delivered his friends. They were against him, but through Job, the friends were delivered, and he offered sacrifices for them. Now Daniel, this word Daniel is spelled differently here from our Daniel in the book, which led some to think it was a different Daniel that you read about in some secular history back there. But probably it was because Daniel was still a young man. But I'm persuaded that Daniel, by this time, was having his influence with Nebuchadnezzar and the ruler to the point that Ezekiel could use him. So I think he's talking about Noah and the Daniel that they knew there at the court and Job. He writes for now. What's the point? If all three of these men were in Jerusalem, all in the world they could save would be themselves. I won't spare the city on behalf of the few that are there because it's going beyond that. It's reached the point that I'm going to destroy that city. It's reached the point. All right, so what's our lesson? I might, by my influence somebody else. And by my teaching, I might. But I can't save anybody but whom I hear. I can't save my children. I can't save the congregation for which I'm preaching. You can't either. All I can do is save whom I hear. That's all you can do. Save yourself. So that's not selfishness. That's just the way God fixed it. I cannot impute my own faith to somebody else. He's got to have that himself. So what God is saying is, when this famine comes, I know it first of all here, he says here, if I send the famine upon them here, all right, they can save on themselves. And he repeats that with another thought. And he goes on here, verse 15, if I cause evil beasts to pass through the land, and that they ravage it, and it be made desolate, so that no man may pass through because of the beast, maybe that was a foreign army, I don't know, maybe a wild beast, but either way you want it. Though these three men were in it, as I live, saith the Lord Jehovah, they should deliver neither sons nor daughters. They only should be delivered, but the land should be desolate. Right, now there's your famine, and here your evil beast here. Now then the third, he goes on to say, or if I bring a sword, so the others up here would be wild beasts that would come through and take over. If I bring a sword upon that land and say, sword, go through the land, so that I cut off from it man and beast, though these three men were in it, as I live, saith the Lord Jehovah, they should deliver neither sons nor daughters, but they only should be delivered themselves. So that three times, and here it goes a fourth time. Or if I send a pestilence into that land and pour out my wrath upon it in blood to cut it from to cut off from it man and beast, though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, saith the Lord Jehovah, they should deliver neither son nor daughter. They should but deliver their own souls by their righteousness. So as I said in the beginning of the book of Ezekiel. Now, the earlier prophets emphasized the nation. Take, for instance, the book of Amos and Hosea. They were talking about the nation, the kingdom. Now you come a couple of hundred years later, you come down to Ezekiel. Now, Ezekiel is now putting the emphasis on the individual. Now, he does it here. Now, when you come to the 18th chapter, again, he puts the emphasis on the individual and in chapter 33. So, here, over and over, he now puts the emphasis on the individual and not the nation. So, all that an individual can change is himself, and all he can save is himself. All my righteousness will save is myself, and so also will you. Right now, I realize that, as Jesus said, you are the salt of the earth, that we can influence and all of that. And it may be by the righteousness and the salt of the individuals, we may avert a judgment on our land. We may do that. But if such a judgment comes, all I can deliver, all you can deliver, will be yourself. See, that's the emphasis here. So, we'll all stand before God as individuals. I can't stand for anybody but myself, but I will have to stand for myself. So, when I'm right or when I'm wrong, I don't have to answer for that. So will you. Nobody else can. This is the emphasis God's now placing here on this matter of his people. That it's a personal, individual responsibility. You can't save anybody but yourself. Now, we talk about it, and God has to do that. That's what Paul said when he came back and they reported all things that God had done with them. See, they didn't do it themselves. It was God doing it with and through them. So, whatever influence I have or whatever God is able to do through me is God working through me, and it's really what he is doing and not what I'm doing. I think that really is what Paul is stressing also in the book of Romans there, is the individual's own faith and righteousness here by which he is saved. Well, all right, man, that's a good lesson. We need to learn that. A lot of folks think, well, maybe because I was this or that, but God will do something to somebody else. He might or might not, but he's not going to save him because of what I did. He's going to save him because of what he does, who he is, what he is. That's the ground of it. Any question? All right, we'll move on from that. Now, notice he concludes this. For thus saith the Lord Jehovah, how much more when I send my four sword judgments, the one he just mentioned there, upon Jerusalem? What are they? The sword and famine and the evil beast and the pestilence. He had those same four in Revelation over there, one of the passages there. To cut off from it man and beast. Yet behold, therein shall be left a remnant that shall be carried forth, both sons and daughters. Daughters, behold, they shall come forth unto you, and you shall see their way and their doings, and you shall be comforted concerning the evil that I have brought upon Jerusalem, even concerning all that I have brought upon it. Now, we were reading this passage last night, and Gordon raised the question about how were they comforted. God has said, I'm going to destroy it. The people couldn't accept that. But when this little remnant comes, and you realize how wicked they were, how godless they were, and why I destroyed it, you will find comfort in the fact that it was a righteous judgment. That's what he's talking about. They're not going to comfort you when they come. That's it. Except you'll be comforted in the fact that my judgment was a righteous judgment. It was what the people had coming because of their conduct. And so I think that we sometimes think that God is his judgments are too severe, but they're not. They're never too severe. The judgment is always commensurate with the crime. That's what Isaiah was talking about in balancing the scales. Here he says, I'll give them double judgment for their sin. What do you mean by that? He means I'll balance the scales. But over here is the sins. Here my judgment will be commensurate with that. I'll balance the scale. When you balance the scale, you've got 1 pound over here. You balance the scale, what do you have? 2 pounds, don't you? You've got 2 pounds. You've doubled it there. But he says the same thing in Isaiah toward the close of the book concerning joy. That here I will give them double the joy. What does that mean? I'll give them joy commensurate with the suffering they endured there. So God's judgments are always just. And when a nation or a people have piled these sins up to where they're no longer fit to live, and an inevitable judgment falls, you can always say it was a righteous judgment. Well, that's what Paul said in Romans, the second chapter there. He's saying the judgment of God is a righteous judgment. Now, when an individual stands before God in the final judgment, and hear God say, depart me, you cursed, into the eternal fire, the path of the devil and his angels, these individuals are going to go away saying, it was a righteous judgment. We're going to admit that. For anything God does is righteous. So, and if a nation, if a judgment befalls this nation, and I think it's coming, I don't know what in what way, but I think I see it coming after a number of years, why, we're going to have to say it was a righteous judgment. We got what we had coming. We've been asking for it. Now, it's coming. We talked about old Sodom back then, what God said about it back then, sinful, wicked, all that. And what was the main crime? Well, it was pride, but it was homosexuality and those things for which God destroyed it. Well, you listen to every newscast almost now, and they're trying to vindicate and justify the homosexuals and build up for them that, and give them the job and give them a prominent place and all that sort of thing. Well, what's God going to do about that? Well, whatever he does, you write it down in your little black book. It was a righteous judgment. We got what we had coming to us. All right? Now let's move on and hurry up. I'll comfort you then, and with they shall comfort you when you see their way and their doings. That's what he's talking about. When you see their way and their doings, and you shall know that I have not done without cause all that I have done in it, saith the Lord Jehovah. So you see that they says what I've already said beforehand, just said. That when you see their ways and how they're acting and their character and all that, then you know that I acted justly in destroying Jerusalem. What terrible, terrible destruction, yeah. And that destruction, I'm quite sure that the destruction over in the Middle East there, that was a righteous judgment. I feel it was a righteous judgment. I don't think we comprehend and fully know all the wickedness of the people there and their endeavor toward God and all that. And now then, when it comes upon us, and how would it come? I don't know. You thought about it this way. Our banks, our savings and loans have been bad shape. Our banks, I talked to a man yesterday who said better in the know than I am. He said the banks in our country are in a terrible shape. They're much more than we know today. He said when that breaks, it's going to be bad for the savings and loans company. All right? Now, suppose then that our judgment is a financial, total financial collapse. All right, then what's going to happen then? Well, that which we thought we were going to live on is gone. That which we thought we would have our old age is gone. And I don't have it anymore. Our nation is practically bankrupt. It's on the verge of trillions of dollars in debt and no effort to pay it back. Whatever. How long can that go on? I don't know. It'll go on until God says this is far enough. Time for the judgment over here. You folks over here, you've been asking for it now over the last 50, 60, 100 years. So I'm gonna give it to you. I'm going to let you have what you've been asking for. And so the Christian will be able to say it's a righteous judgment. Your faith in God. I'll say it's a righteous. If I lose everything I've got, have nothing to eat next week, I'll say it all. I'm just a part of the society on which the judgment fell, and it's a righteous judgment. Had it come. Is that what he's teaching? I think it is. Is that a good lesson for us today? I know it is. I know it is. Well, all right. Now then, he has two allegories. One allegory is the allegory of the vine. And I wanted to get to that 16th chapter, but I spent too much time on this. I won't be able to. So we'll just talk about this, and I'll leave the 16th chapter. I may get a little review of it. We have two allegories. Now, one is the allegory of a vine, the vine wood, right? The wood of the vine. Now, the vine occurs many times. Now, Isaiah, the 5th chapter, the Jews were God's vineyard. He set a wall about and all of that. All the way from way back down in Joseph, the vine of Joseph would be able to go out and grow way out and all the influence of it. Even over in the New Testament, John the 15th chapter, I am the true vine. My father is the husband. You're the branches. So the idea of a vine has had a very important place in the Old Testament teaching that illustrates, you see. Israel was Jehovah's vineyard. But now he talks about a piece of vine. Well, let me ask you this question. Charlie, don't you work in wood in video? Work with wood? Have you ever built anything out of a piece of vine wood, of great vine wood? Have you ever taken one of the little stars and made a peg out of it? Never have. You ever see anybody that made a thing out of vine wood? When I read it and got thinking about it a few years ago, I got thinking, well, did I ever see anything made out of vine wood? I don't believe I ever saw anything made out of it. So he uses that, huh?
Walking canes out of vine.
Walking canes? Made out of a grapevine? And they hold up an individual? Oh, that's the only thing I've ever heard of. That's the first one. I'm really going to check in. No question, you won't know. I just maybe so. All right. for maybe a walking stick out of it. But I've never seen anything made out of vine wood, and that'll be the first one. But now listen to what it said. And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, what is the vine tree more than any tree? The vine branch which is among the trees of the forest. What is more than any others? Not any more than any others. Shall wood be taken thereof to make any work? Or will men take a pin of it to hang any vessel thereon? It is strong enough to put up, and that's why I have a hard time thinking they can make a walking cane out of it, because it bears wood and you put a peg, if they break, it's so easy to break that. But at any rate, we'll accept that and go out ahead. Any vessel thereon. No, he never saw that. Behold, it is cast into the fire for fuel. The fire hath devoured both the ends of it, and the midst of it is burned. Is it profitable for any work? Now, if the vine wood were not worth anything for work before you burned it, now you put it in the fire and let it burn both ends and get scorched in the middle, what's that worth? That's not worth a thing at all, is it? No, just let it keep on burning, that's all. But, now behold, when it was whole, it was meet or fit for no work. How much less when the fire had devoured it, and it is burned, shall it yet be meet for any work? Therefore thus saith the Lord Jehovah, as the vine tree among the trees of the forest, which I have given to the fire for fuel, so will I give the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Now, as if vine wood was not worth anything before it was burned, it isn't worth anything after it's burned, and just and except a little piece of charcoal left. So he said, I'm going to do to Jerusalem. When I get through the fire of the people in the fire of Jerusalem, it's not going to be worth any more than a piece of vine wood had been burned on both ends and scorched in the middle. That's a pretty good figure, isn't it? Pretty strong figure. I'm sure they got the point. Now, no further. And I will set my face against them. They shall go forth from the fire, but the fire shall devour them, and you shall know that I am Jehovah. Now, a few are going to try to escape, and there will be a remnant. There will be a small remnant that will escape. He keeps before them that remnant all the way through his book. That's why we have the remnant, but the Jerusalem, the city as such, is going to be destroyed. When they go forth from it, what that little group that comes over here, when you see them and see what they were worth, how worthless they are, you'll understand why I destroyed the city. But look a little further. You shall know that I am Jehovah when I set my face against them, and I will make the land desolate because they have committed a trespass, saith the Lord Jehovah. So, the whole lot of doom in this book, isn't there? Very few things thus far have been of a comforting nature. But now as the book develops and goes on, more and more, the prophet is going to turn from doom to the other side, to worthwhile and comfort and those things. But before they get to the comfort, there's the doom. And so I think that we can study such lesson with prophets. That's one allegory, the allegory of the burnt vine, piece of vine wood. All right, now second allegory. Now I'm just going to give a little brief summary of what's in the 16th chapter. I want to read it next time. This, I think, is one of the most revolting allegories in the book. And that's one reason why it's very seldom read and very seldom preached upon and read in public. In this, Jehovah, I'll tell you what's in it, and then we can read it next time. I am going to read it. It'll take the whole time just to read it with a comment or two because it's a long one. But in this allegory, he takes a foundling babe, that is a babe that's cast off by its mother and father, and here is weltering in its own blood out here. And now then, Jehovah comes along and finds this and cleans it up and develops it into a beautiful young woman, and then he engages himself and she becomes his wife. Well, now that's a picture of Jerusalem. Jerusalem here and the people of it, when God found them, why, they were just as if cast off. Now then, he develops them and makes out of them the great nation they became under Solomon. And he goes on to deal with that. And so now, but what happened to them? Well, now then, when they got to that point, no longer needed God, now they turn to idolatry, which is spiritual adultery. And so she becomes an adulterer, a spiritual adulteress against Jehovah. Not only that, but she became a harlot. She sold herself to these nations for where she could get out of it. Then she became worse than a harlot. A harlot always serves to hire for her own. But he said, you have paid people to commit harlotry with you, You went out here and paid them. You made agreements with them. Well, you sold yourself for what you got out of it. All right, so you're worse than a harlot. Then he goes on then from that to deal with them as such. And now, and it's a very revolting picture. Well, if you read it this week, you will see it is a revolting allegory. Then he moves from that to the two sisters, Judah and Israel. Then he shows that Judah became worse than Israel, and even worse than Sodom, whom he destroyed, because she knew better but didn't do better. And so he now takes them, and so when he gets through with this allegory, the allegory of the foundling child, the allegory of the two women, the two sisters, and others, that puts them even Judah beneath Sodom there. And that's bad enough. Why wouldn't you do it? Now here you have three allegories in this. You have the allegory of the vine wood, which indicates the worthlessness of it to start with, and when it's burned, it isn't worth anything. Then the allegory of the baby he had found, developed after I married. God gave him glory and all of that. And he used that for the idols. He clothed the idols and used the gold and silver for idolatry. Then she committed not only spiritual harlotry, but political harlotry. She made her sold herself to those nations in agreements with them in Assyria, Egypt, and others there. So here you have not only religious, but political dealings here. And yet they claim to be the people of God. Now, there's not an exact parallel between that and a nation today. Because no nation today is a nation in the sense that the Jews were God's own people. But there is a sense in which when a nation that God has blessed so richly and done so much for, when that nation then turns away from God and refuses to recognize him and commits this adultery with all the nations round about for, I don't know, profit or whatever it may be. And some of them, it looks to me like we got like they back and we give them everything for in order to get their, well, their good feelings toward us and all that. Yet they all hate us when we get through. I think we're following the pattern there of the people back out. Don't misunderstand. We are not God's special people, except as God has blessed the nation with special blessings. I think above any nation that's ever been, we've had the greatest blessings. Now, if when we do that and turn away from God and turn to materialism, militarism, and immorality, and the home breaks down, and God is cast out of our thinking, and everything is done today and by the politicians and the educated, big educators, all of that is anti-God. It's trying to rule God out of our thinking and everything and solve all our problems on the basis of human wisdom and human judgment. Well, now, when you thumb your nose at God, what's he going to do about it? He's going to take it to the woodshed. I think that these studies will help us to read the paper better, to watch television news with a little bit better understanding of what is in store for this nation when it goes on like it's going now. I don't see any indication of a returning or a turning to God. Turn to religion, yes, but to God, in the true sense, very little life. Or thinking about it. Right, let's take that 16th chapter next Sunday. In spite of the fact that I don't like to read it, but I think we need to. I would tell you just read it for yourself. We'll read it in comments. See what God says. God said it was one. It's an ugly picture. And Ezekiel knew it was an ugly picture. But what is the lesson? The lesson, class, is the ugliness of sin. It's trying, in my time, to make the people realize the ugliness of sin. And as I said a while ago, the repulsiveness of sin. And they're rebuking it here. That's what we want to see in it. And old Ezekiel, but Ezekiel here, he met that thing head on with one of the ugliest allegories you'll find in the Bible. Let's take it next Sunday. Christ is cute.